are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This begins Disc 8.
Part 3, Chapter 51, After Graduation. In 1 month after graduation, I was dancing with a boy named Jim at the Rehabilitation Center for the Blind in Butner, North Carolina. I had been home for 3 weeks, been to the beach with Larry and Linda and Donald one weekend, made gallons of lemonade, shucked hundreds of ears of corn, and sewed up some old feed sacks for Daddy to use in his gardening. I knew if I stayed around Lexington very long, Larry and I would become close like we were before I had left for school. Yet I also knew I still had a lot of growing up to do. Then I went to Butner to wait for a place to become available at Duke University in the medical transcription program they had set up for the blind. Butner was a wonderful place with a nearby swimming pool and a little place just like the Bright Spot. The center was really set up for people who had lost their vision later in life to teach them Braille and how to accomplish things as a blind person. For students who did not plan to graduate from our school, and students who needed a little guidance before going on to other pursuits, or students like me, who just wanted a place to hang out until another place opened up somewhere else. As I danced with Jim on that Wednesday night, July 10th, Donald never crossed my mind. Jim was soon the only boy in my heart. The next day was my birthday, and Donald called to say that he was going to come to see me on Saturday. It felt like we were on a different planet. I didn't want to see Donald. I told him not to come. That Friday, I tried to figure out what was happening to me. For hours, I laid on my bed all afternoon and night. It felt like I was in shock. It happened so fast, it made me dizzy. I felt that I had never loved anybody until dancing with Jim. My breakup with Donald was cruel, quick, and forever. Then in November, the Spot opened up in Durham, and I was on my way. I moved into the YWCA in Durham. It had never occurred to me that for most of my life I had been in a sheltered environment, at least not until realizing the environment was gone. There were 3 other girls in the program, and I found myself bumping into the past and the future every time I opened my room door. For a time, I roomed with Hazel from school, but it was not long until Hazel moved back to Raleigh. I then roomed alone without the skills necessary to make friends or relate to the other girls at the Y. It felt like making friends with sighted girls was impossible. We were served breakfast and an evening meal Monday through Friday at the Y, and our last provided meal for the week was on Saturday mornings. The Commission for the Blind had given me $72 each month for my expenses. Daddy was supposed to make up the other $90 the Commission thought it would take for my needs for the rest of the month. Daddy never did figure this out, as $72 a month sounded like a lot of money to someone who was born in 1922. As I walked down the streets of Durham, often people approached me begging for money. Didn't they know I was blind and needed my money as bad as they needed theirs? Blindness did not turn a warm heart to me one bit. On weekends, I bought cans of pork and beans and Vienna sausages only to realize I didn't know how to open a can. All those pie crusts I had been taught to make at school, yet a can of beans eluded me. Ask someone to help me and show the poor blind girl how to open a can was not an object for my pride. Many weekends I spoke to no one from Friday evening until Monday morning. I was no longer the prettiest, smartest, or most popular girl in school or anywhere else. I was nobody. I wanted to hide or run away again, but there was no place to go that would change things. I realized somehow it was up to me to sink or swim, and I felt myself sinking into the despair from which I felt there was no return. I call this phase of my life being socially inept, no matter how much they had taught us at school. I knew very little about life and the outside world. This phase of my life felt like it lasted a very long time, although really it didn't last but about a year. Since my communication skills were so poor, or else my personality was so shy, I worked relentlessly while often my office mates would laugh together or eat nabs and drink coffee. Duke University Hospital was a large place where I felt insignificant and small, yet medical transcription seemed to be the easiest thing I was doing at the time. In September of 1964, I was hired at Duke to help start a transcription service for other departments at Duke who had an overflow of work. I was excited when Jim came over to Durham and took medical transcription just about the time I started to work. We dated while he was there, and I felt sure he would ask me to marry him. It was a rainy night in Durham's bus station, the night he informed me that his mother did not want him to marry a blind girl. I knew then that in spite of Jim's limited vision, it was Jim who did not want to marry a blind girl. Crushed in knowing this, I walked down the streets of Durham alone back to the Y. Thinking of how it was meant to be, perhaps Donald's revenge on my own heart. Should I call him? But all I could think of when I thought of him was Ellen saying that he had called me a clinging crybaby girl. I would not call Donald. Instead, I thought of Billy and called him. True to my friend's nature, the next day he was at my side, smiling and offering to help me through my troubles. He was willing to ride the bus 30 miles from Raleigh to console me. My head felt so comfortable on his shoulder, and he began to make me think I had finally come home. Oh, what a comfort he was! I showed him around Durham, and just like people had thought at school, waiters in restaurants or clerks in stores always thought that we were the perfect couple. But we weren't. Billy looked at me and said, "You must surely know that I love you." I pondered his words all evening. Did I love him? Jim was gone and Donald was gone. I realized that was the only reason I had called Billy and felt ashamed. Somehow, Donald and Billy were both great friends that I would always treasure, but I realized they were friends from school, childhood friends, and special friends forever, but not boys I was ready to marry. No matter how much I wanted to, I could not make myself fall in love with Billy, this wonderful person I had known since age 7. Though I loved him as the most special friend I ever had, it was time for me to release him in order for him to find his true life's love that I could never be. I felt guilty for having called him. No matter how Jim had hurt me, Jim was the name I talked to God about. After telling Billy this, he went back to Raleigh, leaving me to figure out my own life while he searched for the person that would be the true love for him. Billy left me on the steps of the Y with our memories of our childhood all special between us. The next morning, I went downtown and bought more sad record albums to better cry about my life. Laverne came over to visit me for a weekend, and finally, I realized I could still laugh. She went downtown to the record store with me and introduced me to Bob Dylan. Then we went swimming in the Holiday Inn pool next door. On Sunday, we visited a mutual friend we had met at the rehab center named Sue Smart. Sue left us alone for a while to go to the store. As usual, Laverne and I decided to plunder her apartment kitchen to see what we could find. We found a bottle of wine. Just as if it were a can of beans, we had no idea as how to open the bottle, but we were determined to find out. We twisted and turned, pulled, bit, and finally found something that looked like it was drill a hole right through the top. Suddenly, the cork flew across the room, and we found ourselves on our knees looking for it, just as though it were that artificial eye back in school. We found it and tasted the sweet red liquid. It burned on its way down our throats and reminded us of Hattie Marshburn's candy, but we drank it anyway. Then realized how hard it was to try to put the cork back in the bottle. As mine and Laverne's lives would have it, just as soon as we finished enjoying our little escapade, the new Christy Minstrels song played from Sue's stereo. I'll drink your sweet wine. Unlike telling Hattie about the candy, we did not tell Sue about the wine until much later. I did go to Lexington many weekends, and even though I knew that Lexington was a place where I was loved, it felt unfamiliar. Larry, who had loved Linda since age 17, married her in November of 1963. I loved them being married, although I had no way to travel or friends to hang out with when I went home. During the winter of 1964, soon after starting to work, I contracted a cough. I was working alone in the office when a young man stuck his head in the door and asked me if I needed some cough medicine. I looked up to see a lab coat and dark hair. He said he would bring me some medicine. The next day, he came in and asked me if he could take me home. I said yes. His white jacket was one of an intern, and his dark hair and sideburns reminded me of Elvis. I felt like his eyes seemed to see right through me. It occurred to me that I had never dated a sighted boy before, and was proud when he picked me up at the Y on Friday night for dinner. Yet I was nervous, and he realized it. Even though Jim was the love in my heart, suddenly my life began to change. Pizza evenings and movie Saturday evenings began. His name was Bobby Lee, and his goal seemed to be to help me shed my shy shell. I became comfortable with him, and he introduced me to beer with my pizza. I never acquired a taste for it, but that was all right with him, and he introduced me to some of his friends. Once he did finally get through my shyness, probably lots of folks wished he had not. Soon, young ladies at the Y began to speak to me, asking me if my friend, the young doctor, had friends so we could double date. Other young interns called occasionally, and my life changed even more. Brenda, my office mate, made friends with me, and if we were not dating, we cruised the hamburger joints on Friday nights. Was this what life was outside of those protective school walls? Is this how everybody else lived? No matter how many new friends I began to make, I found myself unprepared for life. Where had all my friends like those from school gone? Chapter 52, Epiphany. Finally, in the spring of 1965, I went back to the now newly named Governor Moorhead School to visit some of my old friends. It was impossible not to stop on the train bridge and gather my thoughts. Nausea churned in my stomach, and the excitement almost overtook me as I slowly left the bridge and walked through the gates. The campus felt the same. The acorns crunched under my feet, and the umbrella of the new green leaves seemed to move as though they were whispering a soft welcome. All the years I had been gone seemed to drop away. I ran to Fisher Cottage. If I could, I would have lived in Fisher Cottage forever. I ran up the stairs and threw my arms around Jackie. She was playing Crazy Eight with some of the other girls, and I eagerly dealt myself in. Still, as the afternoon slipped by, I found myself feeling as though I was sitting on the outside of the circle looking in. As I walked back off campus, I stopped once more on my bridge. That old shaky wooden thing that had trembled over the trains and scared us silly as little kids. Now I stood at the rails, praying for a train to come rumbling by and complete my melancholia. I stood there, the arms of my heart hugging this wonderful place that had taught me everything I needed to know except how to say goodbye. Memories crushed my soul as I tried to brush them away once more. How had my friends done it? Leaving and gone on with their lives? How does anybody say goodbye to places of their childhood? In my mind, I heard echoes of pianos being practiced down the music halls. I heard jump ropes tap, tap, tapping the rhythms of little girls' play. Radios all playing different stations falling out the windows of Fisher Cottage. The music of the carousel from Pullen Park reaching across Ash Avenue into our windows. And the woodpecker who landed on the roof of Cook Cottage just close enough to the vent to let us know spring had arrived. I saw the lights of the large Christmas tree in the middle of campus, and I thought of the campus lights shining in our windows, peeping into our thoughts. As little girls, those large octagon posts with lights were home free for hide-and-seek. In Cook Cottage, they were our protectors from would-be escaped prisoners from Central Prison, and in Fisher Cottage, they got in the way of the kisses goodnight we tried to steal. I heard the mockingbird singing late into the night. I tasted the Tuesday vegetable soup and cheese toast lunches, the Thursday night ice cream, and the sweet sandwich I had learned to love. I felt the snowflakes of our winters, our bare feet on the hot May concrete, and the little dots that had taken us from nowhere to everywhere Braille could lead. This had been my home, my heart's resting place. I no longer cared about the sad things like the unattended broken ankle I had suffered, the artificial eye that still should be real, or the yardstick across my bare bottom wielded at the hand of Mrs. Johnson and Kay. My heart was screaming, "Take me back. Please let me come home." As I stood there, I smelled the rain long before it made its way through the oaks and pines. Always rain, as the rain itself meant goodbye. Then a train rumbled underneath the bridge. As the bridge shook, the fear of the little girl and the fear of the grown-up me met. How could I break out of this blind bondage into an uncaring world? Were all the things they told us at school just lies? Did any of them have real knowledge about how it was on the outside for a blind person? I felt like the bird pushed from the nest without my flying wings. Then I remembered the long weekends after graduation with nobody to talk to and smiled as I thought of my new friends to be with. I remembered the money crunch while I was in training and felt proud now as I earned my own salary in a prestigious institution such as Duke. Maybe my wings were growing from somewhere inside me, somewhere so deep that even music couldn't hear them grow. No one knew I loved to sing and play the piano. No one cared, and neither did I. Perhaps my wings needed to be clipped in order to grow back anew in an ordinary fashion. However, I realized also that blindness would never be an ordinary lifestyle. It would be up to me to pack those wings with the old knowledge from school and new knowledge from life. I slipped quietly into that place, no place special, and began learning to fly. Epilogue. I have been flying, soaring, and resting my wings ever since. In the winter of 1965, I moved to Raleigh to work at Wake Medical Center. In July of 1966, Jim knocked on my door. "I came to ask you if you would come with me to pick out the rings I hope you will marry for the rest of your life," he said on one knee. Jim and I were married in October of 1966. In 1967, I sang at Billy's wedding to Aline Luck, with my voice trembling just a little on the A. We all remained friends through the years. Together, they had three children, and our families became close friends. In 1973, our little class had a 10-year reunion over the weekend. Everyone in our senior class came. On Saturday night, we had a dance and invited everyone who had been to school with us to attend, and the dance floor was filled. Jim made friends with everybody and was as much a part of the group as though he had been to school with all of us. Jim and I had two beautiful, blonde-haired, blue-eyed children, Kevin and Christy. Together, we watched them grow for 20-plus years. The scales seemed to have balanced themselves, my childhood sadness on one end and the happiness of love, children, a husband, and a home on the other. I'd like to say that we all lived happily ever after. However, this is not a fairy tale. After 23 very happy years, Jim and I reached a crossroads we could not straighten. We divorced, causing me to stumble backward for a while as I searched for a steady equilibrium. Many times I thought of those steps at Fisher Cottage and the black lady whose name I never knew, and took strength from remembering those moments. I found God for myself during that time in a stronger way than ever before. There are very many stories I could write about the crazy good love of my children and my three grandchildren, about so many wonderful friends who give me such tremendous love and encouragement, and mostly about my faith in God's amazing, healing, unending love. Someday, I hope to publish some of my many poems and stories about these things. I have remained friends with most of the people mentioned in this book. I have not seen Anne again, but talked to her recently and learned that she went to college and taught blind children in the public school for years. Carolyn became a social worker in South Carolina. She was married and had two beautiful girls. Hazel, who had been so good taking care of us while at school, ran a nursery from her home for years. She was married and her husband died after 30 years. She now lives with her sister in Wendell, North Carolina. I talked with her recently. Jackie and I still talk when we know that we have two interrupted hours during a day. She married Bill Hastings in 1967, has two wonderful girls, lives in Morganton, and keeps children for some parents to work. Bill signed for the deaf school in Morganton for years. On December 14, 2013, I had a chance to visit for a long while with Ronnie Millsap. "You wouldn't date me while we were in high school," he said. "You never asked me," I reminded him, as we both laughed. We drank Perrier as we reminisced over the fun times, teachers, good and bad memories, and stopped exactly where we are in our lives today. Last year, he was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, but he will always live in those North Carolina School for the Blind Halls of Fame in my memory. Laverne and I have visited throughout the years. She has three children and married Charles Hems several years after her first husband died. She lives in Charlotte. During one of my visits, Charles had planned to fix us a big breakfast. "How many eggs do you want?" he asked. "None," we replied. "We just ate the entire batch of fudge you made last night." Some of those I have known are no longer living. They include Donald, who died in 1987 after heart surgery. Donald and I remain friends until he died, and his mother and sister are special friends to me even today. Shelby Jean died in 1965 during a heart catheterization. In 2001, I gave a eulogy at Billy's final service, singing an improvised a cappella version of Danny Boy. Carolyn died in 2013 of breast cancer. Belvia died on July 4, 2014. I treasure the day I visited Belvia and sat beside her hospice bed one Sunday as we listened to Pat Boone favorites and Elvis Presley hymns together. My daddy died in 1988, and Mom is now age 94. I go to Lexington to see her often. She still lives in the house she moved into when I was in the first grade. It seems ironic that now I am the one who leaves her. My vision has deteriorated since the surgery when I was 10. I got my first guide dog in 1995. It was and is sometimes hard for me to totally trust the dog when I think I see something that is not there or don't see something that is. Hopefully, I will always be able to see the sunshine, lights, shadows, and some color contrast. After participating in the laughter of so many totally blind friends and watching them travel through life doing ordinary things with calm dignity, I realize there are many worse things than being blind. I must admit, I am thankful for the light I can still see, for talking computer screen readers, for smartphones and audio description for plays and movies, and for all the programs designed to aid blind and visually impaired people. Mostly, however, I am thankful for Braille and for an education that has served me well throughout my life. It is a gift, paid for with a high price, from my parents and many teachers who probably didn't even realize the truth of all that was happening. A personal note. Today, I live in Raleigh, North Carolina, with my newest guide dog, Vivi. My daughter Christy lives 3 miles away with my two granddaughters, Brittany and Taylor. My son Kevin lives just across town with his wife Tanya and my grandson Jonathan. I enjoy using my very limited vision to see pictures of my children and grandchildren displayed in brilliant contrast on the iPad. I was a medical transcriptionist for over 40 years. Today I enjoy writing short stories, poetry, and songs. I still play the piano and some violin. Things are good, and I often find much humor as I experience life as a special needs person in an everyday world. I don't rub my hands down fur coats anymore. But don't be surprised if you might happen to see me making a face at a clerk who just points and tells me that what I am looking for is right over there, or tries to hand my change to my friend. You may visit me most weeks on my blog at myrashouse.blogspot.com. I would enjoy hearing from you.
This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and was prepared in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. The author wishes to make further acknowledgments to her friend Jennifer Raven, who sat beside her many days as she worked and perused every word written, who has shared in the story as if it were her own, who has taken care of any computer glitches, gone through countless books, annuals, magazines, and personal photographs for clarity and information, and has attended an editing class with the author. She has advised on forum, encouraged with her own belief in the project, and ultimately displayed that belief into the digital format of the final copy for you to enjoy. Next, thanks to Alice Osborne, editor and counselor on Writing from the Inside Out. Alice helped the author search her soul in a deeper way, to pull out things as they were and not how they might have been wished to be, and not to be afraid of the truth and its expression. As she edited out some things, she encouraged other things to be added. Her insight was necessary in order to release the feelings which build the story. Thanks to another friend, Laverne Gallant, who has encouraged the author in writing for years and who experienced so many of these chapters with her. And lastly, thanks to her grandson, Jonathan Christian DeBruhl, who is a student at North Carolina State University in the School of Graphic Design. It was Jonathan who designed the cover of the book using an image of the original school bell used on the campus of the North Carolina State School for the Blind. We hope you have enjoyed this presentation.